G'day, and thanks for joining us for another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. I'm DK, and I'm joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Ardeet. Today is Thursday, the 2nd of May, 2024, and our topics this week are Elon Musk has hit back, the Australian court order against Twitter's images of the stabbing. If you don't know what stabbing we're talking about, stick around for that one. And a crippling virus has threatened Australia's chocolate supply. This is not a clickbait headline. This, you need to stick around for this one because it's pretty grim. Of course, we have our Two Ticks Town Talk, and then we'll jump into This Week in Australian History with our Ardeet. We're going to finish off, as always, with our 4X bottle top question. But before we get into all of that, let's catch up on the last week. Ardeet, what's been going on with you?
G'day, DK. I've had the house to myself for a couple of days. My wife's gone up to New South Wales she wanted to see an art exhibition. I wasn't as interested in it, and it was a good opportunity for her to, you know, have a bit of enjoy some time for herself and me to have some time here. We both like to do that at various times during the year, so it worked out well. So yes, I've been running rampant at home. I actually saw a couple of horror movies. I've been really disappointed in horror movies over the last 15 years. I haven't had a high hit rate. Probably the scariest one I've seen, and it might have been a bit longer than 15 years ago, was the Japanese version of The Ring. That was one that really, it had been a long time since I sat there thinking, oh God, I don't think I would, I really shouldn't be watching this. So I do like to have that that feeling. But I saw, they were both, well, one was filmed in Australia, and I actually went and saw it at the movies. It was called Late Night with the Devil. And look, it was, if you hadn't been into horror movies before, there would have been a lot of stuff there that you'd have thought, oh my God. But if you don't mind horror movies, it wasn't particularly scary, but it was well written, and it was a good, I thought it was a decent movie. I gave it 3.8 out of 5. But I also saw another Australian horror movie called Talk to Me. And it was obviously Australian. I mean, it was Australian filmed, Australian actors, Australian setting. And it centered around essentially a possessed hand, which might sound a bit funny, but it was, yeah, I'm just trying, I think it was 2022 or something.
I think a lot of horror movies have kind of, when you try and explain them to someone, the storyline kind of sounds quite weak, because I think a lot of horror movies rely on sort of the tension that they build rather than the story to be scary. They sort of rely on that sort of build up and release sort of constantly throughout the movie, which I think is kind of why maybe a lot of horror movies kind of aren't that good. Especially on a second watch, because you kind of know what's going to happen. I think that's kind of a weakness of the genre, just in general.
I agree with you, and you nailed it. Look, there was certainly a couple of ones of that, but I think the thing that I thought was so positive about these two, particularly the Talk to Me, was there was less reliance on that and the spooky music and the suddenly something dropping from the ceiling. And there was actually a little bit of stuff that got into your head and made you sort of imagine a few things. And I did enjoy seeing those. Now, I wasn't scared. I'm still looking for some horror movies that are going to be really scary, but they weren't a bad effort. So look, my wife doesn't like horror movies at all. So it was a good opportunity for me to have a bit of an indulge in that. And so that's what I've been up to. What about you?
My wife likes horror movies. I'm not a big one because I feel like generally speaking, they're not that good films. I'm a bit of a film buff, and I sort of want a quality story. And unfortunately, as I sort of said, a lot of horror movies just kind of fall a bit weak in that area. However, that's not the case. Sometimes they're really, really good. And I definitely enjoy something like that. I'm not a big jump scare guy. It really annoys my wife that I almost never get a fright. I'm very, very difficult to scare, but I'm also a veteran. So if you do scare me, it's generally not the outcome people want necessarily. So, you know, it's probably not a bad thing, but, we've been watching a show, I think it's on Prime, called When, I think it is. Hang on. Let me double check because I'll butcher this.
On Prime, you said?
I think it's on Prime, yeah.
Amazon Prime, right, okay.
Yeah, Amazon Prime, sorry. And it is quite good. We were also watching a show called From that was, I think we're waiting for it to be renewed. And again, it's not really scary, but it does have a bit of a good, because it's a series. What I'm trying to say is I feel like the series is, can kind of do the story a bit better, and they can build that tension up over a longer period of time. And as a result, some of the horror or thriller TV series can actually be more kind of enjoyable, kind of quote unquote horror experience than just a 90-minute movie. So I quite like those, though my wife really loves them, but she'll never watch them by herself. I always have to watch them. So, which is fine. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then when the tension's building, you know, the music's building and you're ready for a jump scare, I normally scare her right before the jump scare comes. Yeah. I'm terrible. I'm really bad at that. And so she kind of...
How does that go down?
Oh, every time. It's absolutely terrible. She hates it. I think it's hilarious, though. So... But anyway, let's move on because Elon Musk has hit back at the Australian internet watchdog's attempts to force his social media platform, Twitter. I refuse to call it X. It's very confusing in conversation. I will call it Twitter from here on out. His platform, Twitter, into blocking users from seeing violent footage relating to the Sydney church stabbing. This all occurred last Monday. The federal court ordered Elon Musk's Twitter to hide the posts containing videos of the stabbing at Sydney's church last week. The week before, from users globally, after the eSafety Commissioner launched an urgent court appeal seeking an injunction. Some hours later, the American billionaire posted on his personal Twitter account a cartoon showing the platform as a Wizard of Oz-style path to freedom, being Twitter, being freedom and truth, with a darker alternative path to censorship and propaganda, which included, I think, every other social media platform. And above the cartoon, he wrote, "Don't take my word for it, just ask the Australian Prime Minister." He also reposted a number of Twitter posts highlighting a quote by Anthony Albanese on Monday in which the Prime Minister talked about the fact that by and large most social media sites had responded positively to the Australian attempts to block the footage. Musk added in the repost saying, "I'd like to take a moment to thank the PM for informing the public that this platform is the only truthful one." On Tuesday, Anthony Albanese, not too happy with that, said that the government would do what's necessary to take on this arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law, but also above common decency. Might be something in that. He said that the eSafety Commissioner was doing her job to protect the interests of Australians. The idea, and I quote, he said, "The idea that someone would go to court for the right to put up violent content on a platform shows how out of touch Mr. Musk is. Social media needs to have a social responsibility with it. Mr. Musk is not showing any." This is pretty scathing words from the Prime Minister there. It followed a successful court bid late on Monday by the eSafety Commissioner to secure the order against Twitter. Twitter, along with Meta, Facebook's parent company, were ordered by the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman Grant, on Tuesday last week to remove the material deemed to depict gratuitous or offensive violence with a high degree of impact or detail within 24 hours or potentially face fines. What was the video? I hear some of you screaming. What is the video that has caused all of this kerfuffle? It was footage of the alleged stabbing of Bishop Marmari Emmanuel last Monday evening while he was giving a live streamed service at the Assyrian Christ the Good Shepherd Church in Wakeley in Sydney.
We still on alleged? Or I suppose we have to...
He was stabbed. That's not what's alleged. It's alleged... the culprit, because of course it hasn't gone through the courts and everything like that. Right. So.
Okay. Yep. Okay. We'll but yes, alleged then. Yep.
The video is of the stabbing. In a hearing late on Monday afternoon, barrister for eSafety Commissioner Christopher Tran told Justice Jeffrey Kennett that Twitter had geo-blocked the posts containing the video, meaning Australians could not access them. However, the posts were still accessible globally and to Australians who used a VPN connection that made their IP address appear as though they were outside of Australia. Mr. Musk, all pomp and class, earlier branded the eSafety Commissioner the Australian Censorship Commissar. While his company raised free speech and judicial concerns over the takedown. This is just such a mess in my mind. I'm not a big fan of Elon Musk. I think he's a bit of an ass. He's like a 15-year-old boy that discovered the internet for the first time and just runs around and goes crazy, basically. I do think there's definitely something in what he said. The fact that the Australian government can or is trying to censor an event on a global scale is kind of concerning, that they think that they have that power.
Oh, yep.
Like, this is a multifaceted issue and quite an interesting story because of that. And I think on one hand, the eSafety Commissioner, I think their job is to protect Australians from images like this. I think it's insane that they think that they can block this footage from the internet. Like, the Streisand effect is a real thing. It doesn't work. At the same time, I think Elon Musk is using this to just be a complete ass and basically the court jester, like he continues to do constantly. You know, like calling the eSafety Commissioner the censorship commissar. Like, who are you talking to? Like, what is going on? Like, you know, show a bit of decorum and professionalism. like, what's happening? You know, how do you feel about this? Because I feel like you might feel a bit differently.
Oh, look, I'm with Albo on this. This is a terrible thing. It's a disgrace. So, God, I'm completely with Musk on this one, and the eSafety officer and Albo can get a dog up them over this. It just, look, there's a lot of things I like about Musk. I think historically his legacy is going to be, you know, potentially one of the most important for humanity if he pulls off the journeying to Mars and beyond and colonizing beyond the Earth. If nothing else, he'll certainly be going down as one of the pioneers. From my point of view, he's not an Australian. It's not an Australian company. Australia doesn't own the internet. And he said to the Australian, okay, fine, I hear what you're saying. We're geo-blocking it for Australia. But that's not enough for Albo and the eSafety officer. This search, this constant desire to just extend the powers and the claws to the entire freaking internet, the hubris of that. Look, the eSafety officer, she's an ex-Twitter employee, so I don't think she's going to have a lot of, I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect she may not be Musk's biggest fan. But the attempt to try and censor something from the entire internet, it shows just how out of touch they are with reality. And it shows this freaking golem-like obsession with what they believe they can control and what they want to try and enforce on everybody else in Australia. It's an adult decision. You can bring in arguments potentially about access of underage kids. I mean, you're still going to get into difficulty with the internet, but people who are saying, let's use the traditional under 18 things. I can maybe start hearing some arguments on the censorship there. But if you're an adult, it's your choice what you choose to see, what you choose to click on, where you go on the internet. I mean, I find this extremely, extremely irritating, and I'm loving just how flaccid Albo and the eSafety officer are in comparison to Musk on this. And if Facebook was doing it, or who's another one, Gab, or why am I running out of like Minds, Insta, someone, TikTok, if they were saying, listen, we've given you the geo banning for Australia, that's all you're getting now, piss off, I'd still be on their side as well. I hope that Albo and eSafety officer, that all this, they just fall flat on their face and come out looking stupid about it, because it's a dangerous road to go down, and I feel like part of the incentive is Musk is also getting attacked in the US. I think there's undeniable links between Australia and the US and things like this, and it doesn't surprise me that there's this pressure on here. I mean, look, he's coming out and he's basically giving them the middle finger. I'm not holding any illusions about that, but I'm amused by his middle finger in this instance.
I think what's so weird about this is, and why I think it's so interesting, is the what Musk is doing publicly, and why I call him a bit of a court jester, is because it is all for show, because Twitter did comply. Like, Twitter did exactly what the eSafety Commission had asked them to do after initially kind of dragging their feet. Same as Facebook. Which is just geolocked the posts containing the video, meaning that Australians can't access them, which is what I believe the original request was. But they did that, but he's still carrying on about how it's the truth and, you know, Twitter's the only option and blah, 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 which I guess in a way is kind of his job as CEO and the biggest shareholder.
Oh, it's good marketing.
Yes. So he's running with it as a marketing thing. I just think it's so performative that what he's doing, like, I just see through it, where his company is complying. And like, I would wager, like, the powers that be, the internal people that are actually making these decisions, probably just did it because that's what they do. Like, I doubt that Musk probably had much of a say internally on what was going on. He just likes to cause internet drama for the sake of drama, because that's who he is. He's just a clown. And that's what kind of rubs me the wrong way about this. Like, I completely agree with you. It's insane to me that the Australian government thinks it can just wipe things from the internet. Like, you know, it's ridiculous. I've seen the footage. It's not even that bad in my mind compared to other things on the internet.
Exactly. If it's like people who go on to YouTube and get sucked in by the thumbnails that show, you know, a woman in a bikini or a bloke with these top off, and sort of like, oh, you might catch a glimpse of it and you think, yeah, or you could look just about anywhere else and not have anything left to the imagination.
That's right. You know, there are places for this and everything like that. I do think possibly part of this is, as you said, Julie Grant was the director of public policy in Australia and Southeast Asia for Twitter. So there may be a bit of friction there, and that may be why this is attracted, because I'm sure these sort of companies get similar notifications by other countries probably on a fairly regular basis. Like there's probably an internal office at these social media companies that just handle these sorts of requests, I'd imagine.
Like the EU is just crazy for stuff like this.
EU's, and the UK can be really, really strict on things like this as well. So this isn't like a unique Australian thing. I think, and the reason we're talking about this is because it blew up so publicly. And I think that's purely because Musk wanted to blow it up so publicly.
Oh, I think it takes two to tango. Bloody Albo hasn't been holding back as well. I think his ego has been bruised on this, and he's puffing himself up.
I think he absolutely is. And you know, like they say, if you go and wrestle a pig, you're just gonna get covered in mud, aren't you? So it's kind of wild. This whole thing just kind of blows my mind that it happened at all, because from Musk going off the way he did, and the fact that Prime Minister Albanese and the Australian government responded to that is like, what is going on? The whole thing is just so strange that, you know, that these group of professional people on both sides, obviously Musk is, like I said, he's a jester. He's doing what he's doing. He's doing what he always does. I just can't believe that the PR people in the Australian government was like, yeah, this is a good idea. You should definitely fight him on Twitter. Like, what the hell? That's never going to work.
Yeah, I think it possibly gives an insight into the hunger of Australian bureaucrats for control and power. I think it's
possibly.
You know, sort of throwing a bit of a serious one. I think it's a warning flag thrown up there. If this is indicative of their hubris and indicative of what they're wanting to do, and you know, we've certainly seen particularly this century, but since 1985, a continual ratcheting up of control and surveillance on the Australian people. There's the fun side of it that we've talked about, but there's also a slightly sinister side in this that I'm just looking at that and I'm thinking, that could be a potential bad sign. And I suppose we'll see what happens next. Sometimes these things look like a flag, you never hear from them again. But it's just interesting how much pushback is going on this. It's a real sort of a power play and asserting of position. And unfortunately, the person who's going to get shafted in the end, it's not going to be Musk, it's not going to be the bureaucrats, it's going to be you and me. And that's what always bothers me in these situations.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, we have spoken about this. Australia does have this underlying mentality of sort of like nanny state type stuff, and this plays into that. The fact that, you know, you can't watch him get stabbed. I get it. It's gruesome, and for a lot of people that's inappropriate. I completely understand that. However, I do think that if people want to see it, you know, they're going to find ways to see it anyway. I've seen it before the takedown order, and I could very easily, I'm sure most people listening to this could very easily find a way to access it if they wanted to. I do understand, you know, and unfortunately This a lot of this stuff comes with the caveat of, oh, we're protecting the children and stuff like that. The people that don't consent and da-da-da-da-da. That's where it starts. And, you know, it ends with the Prime Minister fighting a billionaire on friggin' Twitter. it's a very unusual story. Hopefully it won't be something that continues to happen. But I think you've made a good point that it is a bit of a cautionary tale about what the Australian government thinks it has jurisdiction over, and what you, my dear listeners, my fellow Australians, the government deems as for your eyes, or, you know, you're too sensitive to see these things. You must be protected from yourself and your own desires.
Oh, the worst type of care.
That's right. We will decide what is good for you. So I don't know. This whole thing is just very strange. There's no winners here. Musk's an idiot. No. Albanese's got covered in mud. You know, I don't. We know Albanese listens to the podcast, so I'm going a bit easy on him. But you know, probably not the best course of action. Might have done better that with this situation.
Yep, take the win.
Yeah. Let's move on. It's time for our Two Ticks Town Talk.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, man. I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled up.
This week, we're going to talk about something really, really important. Very important. Actually, something that is sacred in Australian culture. The pub.
Huh.
The Australian pub is one of the most enduring and prominent cultural symbols. Every town has a pub, probably more than one. And some might just include other things than a pub. It might be more than a pub. It might be a post office. Some of them have banks, or did have banks in them. Of course, a lot of them are still hotels and they're called that. You can stay. Of course, a lot of them have restaurants and a whole lot more. The pub is a very, very important place, especially if you're in the outback, especially if you're in the Western Queensland outback. Because this week we're going to Western Queensland to a town that has a pub. And it is a very special pub because it's the town's only occupied building. This town is the pub. And this week we're talking about the outback, former ghost town of Bituta, and its pub. So, the elephant in the room, of course, is that some of you may already know this tiny town because of a certain famous satirical newspaper, the Bituta Advocate. It is a lot of fun, but it's actually not located in the town, so we're not really going to talk about it. For those that don't know, it's basically the Australian version of The Onion, the satirical newspaper. While it bears the name of the town, it's actually not really. I think it's from Melbourne, so we're not really going to talk about that.
But that does give a bit of... I didn't... When you said that it's just the only one... There, I didn't realize that, so it makes the Bituta Advocate a little bit more amusing to me now.
It's very funny, which is kind of the joke, is that it's based at the time of its creation, the town had a population of zero. So it is very funny, and it's quite on the nose. Once you know that, it kind of adds to the fun of it. So the actual town of Bituta is located 170 kilometers east of Birdsville. And stands on the vast Gibber Plain. And while it usually has a population of about two or three, depending on how the pub is staffed, it is generally actually a hive of activity. So in 1885, the Queensland government opened a customs post office to collect a toll for stock travelling the stock route. And Bituta was once a Cobb & Co. change station. So we've mentioned the Cobb & Co. company before. It's a bit hard to sort of trace their history of Cobb & Co. just because there's actually a number of different companies had the name, sometimes at the same time. So it can be a little bit confusing about who was doing what, where, and all the rest. But Cobb & Co. basically... was basically like a wagon company is probably the best way to describe it. They started, I think the most prominent or the original one started back in Melbourne, and then it kind of expanded from there. What I want you to think of is mid to late 1800s, wagons, four horses running through the outback, basically, is the gist of it. And what they would do is they would carry post and people primarily, and they would have these sort of stations along the route where they would change the horses, because the horses can only be sort of run for so long before they start getting tired. And if you keep running them, you know, they'll get injuries or they'll get exhausted and things like that. So what they would do to keep up the pace is they would swap over the horses at certain sort of stations along the route. The town of Batuta was one of these stations back in 1885. It was officially surveyed in 1887, but only three streets were ever named. So it's never been a big town. And the Batuta Hotel was constructed in the late 1880s, and it is the last remaining building in the town other than the racecourse, which isn't really a building, but we'll come back to the racecourse. So, in 1895, a police presence was established in the town as the construction of the rabbit-proof fence, which we've spoken about before, in the region was attracting many what they call undesirable characters to the town. And a police station with a court was built in 1915, but it was it was closed in 1930 because an inspection in 1928 found that no one had been taken into custody or placed before the court for more than 5 years. Which is funny because it means it was only actually an effective police station for 8 years in its time before it opened and closed, which is very funny. The hotel operated from the late 1880s to 1997, when its owner, Sigmund Remenko, who was also known as Simon, he retired at 82 years of age. He was originally from Poland. He worked as a grader driver until he bought the Batuta Hotel in 1957, where he owned it and ran it for 47 years, and he was its sole resident until its ill-fated health forced him to close and move. The hotel closed in October 1997, and unfortunately, he passed away in 2004. At which point, the town had no people. It was officially a ghost town. So no permanent residents. There's a very famous photograph of the sign that says, "Welcome to Batuta, population zero." However, in 2017, a man called Robert Hacken, a smash repairer from Logan, bought the long-defunct hotel from the couple that Remenko had left it to, and he restored it with the aim of opening it for the races in August 2018. However, unfortunately, that goal wasn't achieved. They were a little bit behind schedule, and it did reopen on the 20th of July 2020. Of course, for those that remember, 2020 was a turbulent time. Right smack bang in the beginning of, well, the beginning in Australia of the COVID-19 pandemic and the subsequent lockdowns, and really the shutdown of the entire world. However,
God, even how did they manage to social distance out there?
The hotel survived, and it does remain open to this day. I did watch a short video from Robert talking about the renovation of the pub, and he said that when they first walked in, the place was completely derelict for many years, over 20 years at that point. And they started cleaning it up, and there was so much mud and dust on the floor that they thought it was a dirt floor, until as they were sort of clearing things out, they realized there was actually a timber floor underneath all of the dirt that had built up. So it was a big job. It was a really big job. And I think they kind of underestimated how long it was going to take. But it's reopened, and the official population of Batuta today is 3. And look, most people head through there on their way to Birdsville, particularly to the Birdsville races or the Big Red Bash that occurs in Birdsville every year. However, in August, there is the annual Simpson Desert Racing Carnival, and it kicks off in the now former ghost town for a weekend of fun in the desert sun. So, if you are heading to Birdsville, or maybe you like to go for the races, or maybe you just want a weekend outback getaway, you don't have to go all the way to Birdsville. You can stop at Batuta, get a cold pint. I've been assured that the beer is ice cold in the middle of the desert. I can imagine nothing better. They have hot pies, they've said, and you can stay at the Outback Tavern. Or if you're heading, you know, if you're going to Birdsville, it's a good place to stop. Make sure you have plenty of fuel because there's no fuel available there. Make sure you stop in the only pub, the town that is a pub, and say g'day to Rob and his very small team.
Oh, excellent. It's really in the bloody back of nowhere. Yeah, threw it up.
This is very remote.
Google. I saw in their pictures that population 01. But that's, it's funny. There's a couple of, just sort of zooming out, and you're seeing things like, Birdsville and Longreach. A couple of the names I recognize. So I haven't been to that part of Queensland, but I tell you what, if I'm heading up that way, it's only about, from what I can see on Google, it's only about
107 Ks
from Birdsville.
170 on the road, yeah, because the road isn't straight. So
yeah, so that's not exactly too far away, is it? It's worth sort of calling in and checking it out.
Yeah, because you'll be coming from the south, but if you're coming from Brisbane or sort of like the east coast and you're heading towards Birdsville, you would drive straight past it. It is a little bit off the road, you know. It's on that main road, but you sort of do have to detour a little bit. But I think it would be worth the detour. It sounds like a pretty cool, unique place, and it sounds like it's pretty busy as well, considering how remote it is. All that's there, I would urge all of our listeners that are listening that don't know, go and have a look on Google Earth. Make sure you go to satellite view so you really get a good idea of the landscape out here.
Yeah, exactly.
There's the pub, there's the racetrack, and one of the roads is like a runway, a dry weather runway in an emergency. But that's it. There's a house across the waterhole, which I think is a bit of a cattle station, but that's it. There's nothing else there.
Nah, and look, that countryside. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, that sort of outback countryside. But if you're into it, it's just so peaceful and beautiful, being surrounded by all that bloody red dirt, scattered trees, just nothing, and like just that feeling of thinking I've been driving for a couple of hours now and I'm still surrounded by nothing. For me it's a feeling I love.
I find sort of a comfort in that. Maybe it's the sailor in me, but it's a very similar sort of feeling when you're way out at sea and it's just very peaceful and quiet, of course on a nice calm night. The beauty is if you go out there, you'll almost certainly only ever have nice weather. It doesn't rain a lot out here, though in saying that, if you are going out, make sure you look at the forecast, because this is one of those places where it won't rain for 6 months of the year and then it will pour and the whole place will flood. So if you are going to go out there, it is worth, I know it sounds like a joke, but it is actually worth checking if there's going to be some rain. Because if you're not prepared for it, you might be in, a bit of trouble. But
in fact, I noticed in one of those, flicking past one of those pictures just as you were winding up, so I could see that other one, there's a picture of a tow truck with a fully kitted out Land Cruiser on the back. So, you know, at the end of the day, you can be as prepared as you like, but stuff's still going to happen to you.
Damn straight. It's always better to be very prepared and have a plan B and have a friend. And there's no cell phone reception out here too. Don't be fooled. There's no Telstra reception out here. So you'll need satellite phone if you're going, definitely a radio, all that stuff. Lots of water, lots of fuel. You know, it's the odds of something going wrong are small, but if you are going to make the journey, do be prepared. It's not quite as easy as just, you know, chucking the kids in the back of the car, hitting the road and driving off. So little bit of preparation required, but you know, by and large, you should be fine. But I'd imagine if you're a bit of a stargazer, I can't imagine anywhere better than out there, because you would
see. That'd have to be a cracker, wouldn't it?
Yeah. You would see a lot, particularly if you did go to Batuta, because there's just nothing there. There's just the pub. So there's no light pollution other than the pub. You leave the, you know, around the pub and that's it. Super remote. So that's fun.
Yeah.
That is the little town of Batuta in Western Queensland. A bit of a short one because there's not really much to talk about, if I'm honest.
That's fun to hear about something like that. And there was a couple of things there I didn't know, and it's just nice to be able to look at that and think, oh, there's this little hub for a community around there, and a bit of a – well, I bet that's the whole thing about the Two Ticks Town Talk. Some have a lot of stuff. Other things is here's just a little gem.
That's right. And I'm going to let you in on a sneak peek. We're probably going to do a few more pub things. There's a lot in the pubs. There's a lot there. So I actually wasn't going to do this one today, but I was sort of running out of time. So there's more pub Two Ticks Town Talks in the future. We've done lakes, we've done caves, we've done other things. Now we're on to pubs. So watch this space.
Oh, very good.
All right, let's move on. Mother's Day, for at least in Australia, is right around the corner. And unfortunately, a crippling virus is threatening Australia's chocolate supply. Australians eat an incredible 7.5 million tons of chocolate a year. That is a lot of chocolate. That's a huge amount of chocolate. But soon that might change as a destructive disease.
I'm flabbergasted. 7.5 million tons.
That's right. To be fair, I got this from 7 News, so I'm not 100% sure if that's true. But, you know, that's what they broadcast, so we'll run with it. 7.5 million tons of chocolate per year. That's a lot of chocolate. I do wonder how much of that is made in Hobart at the chocolate factory we spoke about just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
But of course, that all might soon change because there is a destructive disease sweeping across cacao trees in West Africa that's going to jeopardize, well, potentially could jeopardize the world's supply of chocolate. Cocoa farmers in West Africa are monitoring the progress of several plant diseases that are ruining crops on a vast scale and pushing up the global price of cacao, the raw material for making chocolate, to record levels. The Ivory Coast and its neighbor Ghana together supply more than half of the world's demand for cocoa. But fungal black pod disease is just one of the many diseases affecting the farmers. Its spread is aided by months of soggy weather in the region. Another major problem in Ghana and the Ivory Coast is cocoa swollen shoot virus, which is transmitted through the mealybugs feeding on the plants. This has resulted between the two, this has resulted in a harvest loss of between 15 and 50%, which is just insane.
Wow, that's because
companies like Hershey's and Cadbury have already increased their prices due to the supply shortages. And of course, the world can't get enough chocolate. The global cocoa and chocolate market is expected to grow from a value of $48 billion US dollars in 2022 to nearly $68 billion by 2029. University of Texas professor of mathematics and author Benito Chen Carpentier described the virus as a real threat to the global supply of chocolate. He said, pesticides don't work well against mealybugs, leaving farmers to try to prevent the spread of disease by cutting out the affected trees and breeding resistant trees. But despite these efforts, Ghana has lost more than 254 million cacao trees in recent years. According to the University of Texas researchers, farmers can combat the mealybugs by giving vaccines to the trees to inoculate them against the virus. However, the vaccines are expensive, especially for farmers on low wages. The vaccinated trees also produce a much smaller harvest of cacao, which can compound the devastation of the virus. Researchers have developed a new strategy which uses a mathematical data to figure out how far apart farmers can plant vaccinated trees to prevent the mealybugs from jumping between the trees. By experimenting with these new techniques, researchers have created two different types of models that will allow the farmers to create a protective layer of vaccinated cacao trees around unvaccinated trees. While this is still experimental, these models are exciting because they could help farmers protect their crops while helping them achieve a better harvest overall. And that's good for the farmers' bottom line and, of course, our global addiction to chocolate. So there's a little bit of hope, but be prepared to pay for more money for your chocolate in the coming years, which, let's be honest, everyone probably is expecting anyway. So my advice to all of you listening, doesn't matter where in the world you're listening from, because we're all affected by this. We're all in the same boat. If you're listening to this and you are in Australia or New Zealand, Mother's Day is coming up next weekend. Buy your mama just a buttload of chocolate. Because soon that might not be able to, you might not be able to. So spoiler this year, tell her there's a global shortage, but not in your house, and give her a lot of chocolate. Just caveat that by next year might not be the same.
Yeah. Well, they're incredible figures. I was doing a rough calculation by whilst we were going through those other figures. That works out to about 4 kilograms, if my calculations are correct. And listeners, as always, if we get something wrong, let us know. Correct us, please. We do like to be corrected. But it worked out to about 4 kilograms of chocolate per person every year.
Wow. Certainly do. Someone's picking up the slack for me. I'm not a big chocolate person. I'm not a big sweets guy. So, you know, if you're that person that's eating 8 kilos of chocolate a year, let me know. I'd like to know the person that's picking up for me. Though, actually, it might be my wife. She's a massive chocolate head. So it might be.
But that's for every person in Australia. So, look, you know, double check those figures yourself. Do the fact check. It's interesting. Like cacao is a massive market and has been since. I'm trying to recall when it was that they first brought back cacao to Europe after the exploration in South America. If my memory is correct, I think that was South America was where it originated. And it was just one of those things. Well, I mean, you've got kids. I'm guessing you've seen their eyes light up the first times they've had chocolate, like sweet chocolate. And it's sort of like, what the hell is this? What have you been hiding this from before? You know, that's, and so it's something that sells itself. We've got some. There's a mob up at Byron Bay that just does what they call it. It's got some sort of hippy dippy, you know, ceremonial cacao thing. So it's not it's not chocolate, but it's actual cacao that you grate and put with a couple of spices.
Yes, I have had that. Yes, yeah,
that's not bad.
I think people buy that thinking it's chocolate, but it's like it's it's not chocolate. Like if you're going into that thinking it's chocolate, you're gonna be very upset about it.
Crushingly disappointed would be my description.
It's like I'm a big fan of the like the 80% cacao dark chocolate, the really really dark chocolate. Yeah. I really like that because I don't have a big sweet tooth, but occasionally, you know, after dinner or something, you go, yeah, I just want a little bit of something. So you get a little square and you go, yeah, that's good. My daughter loves chocolate. Like, you know, little kids love chocolate. Everyone likes chocolate, really. Yeah. And begged me for a piece. Dad, give me some of your chocolate, your special chocolate. It's in, you know, the special chocolate's in the top of the fridge. No one else can reach it sort of thing. So gave her a piece. Oh, she was very upset about the whole thing. It was not what she was expecting at all. So,
oh, that's funny.
I also had a chocolate. Now that I'm thinking about it, there was a chocolate I bought. I think there's a company called, it's something like Willy's Chocolate Factory or something like that. It's not Willy Wonka, but it's very close to that. I want to say it's Willy's or maybe it's Wonka's. I don't know. It's something like that. Anyway, and they did a chocolate, milk chocolate bar with like flaky sea salt in it.
Oh.
And I remember when it first came out, it was on sale and I thought, oh, I'll give it a go because that sounds gross, but it's probably really good. And it was fantastic. It's amazing. It's very much like the salted caramel thing. Yep. And all the Vegemite chocolate we spoke about, I think, the other week, that was also quite nice because that saltiness and the chocolate go together way better than you'd think. And I know there's a lot of chefs that use chocolate almost like a spice. They'll add it to dishes you would never think to add chocolate to. And you don't really taste it per se, but it kind of balances those flavors out. Like I've seen it used in Italian cooking and in stews and things like that. Places that you'd go, what the hell? Like that's not, let me just bust out the chocolate and grate it into your stew. That doesn't seem right. but apparently it sort of gives that more complex flavors and things like that. So I think chocolate's a lot more flexible than people realize, but this is pretty concerning. If 250 million trees have been destroyed in recent years, that's a lot of trees.
And from an economic point of view, I mean, you know, with all the sort of, you know, fun side of chocolate, when you sit back and like, if you look at the confectionery aisle in the supermarket, you're talking about a lot of products and. You only have a lot of products if you've got a lot of people buying those products. It does have a bit of a serious impact. You know, and look, if someone's not a chocolate lover, they're going to sort of say, "Well, boo hoo." But if someone is, predisposed towards that, it's going to be at a time when you don't want to have a bump up in costs anywhere in your budget. If chocolate is part of your budget, it's going to have a noticeable impact. Because it's a commodity. Yeah, cocoa is it's a commodity.
Yeah, and it takes about 5 years to grow a new tree from seed before they start to fruit. So there's quite a long lead time on, and look, I'm sure these farmers are constantly growing and replacing trees and things like that. But the level of devastation we're talking about, 254 million trees in the last few years, that means, and the problem is not solved as much as this vaccine is looking promising. The vaccine trees are new trees that they're planting. So these, we're talking about basically an entire turnover of the crop in the next few years. So this is not something that's going to be fixed anytime soon. There's going to be a really long lag time on this, and you'll probably notice it for over the next couple of years. Chocolate may get very, very expensive, especially at the high end. Yeah. And I'm going to warn you now, it may not go back down. That just may be the new normal in this sort of thing. The good news is for Australians, whilst West Africa is where most cacao trees are, there are some grown in Australia, up near Darwin, up in the tropics. I don't think it's enough to supply Australian demand, but it's not like, even if everything in West Africa went completely terrible and that it was all gone, you'd still see chocolate around. It would just be very expensive.
Yeah.
So for the real big chocolate heads, don't panic too much. Just a little bit. Start stocking up.
Yeah. When you're doing the research on this, was there a reason, or are they trying to attribute a reason as to, like, was there a sort of an explosion in the mealybug population or something new here? Because I would imagine that the chocolate plantations are going to be probably similar to the monocultures that are always susceptible to incidents like this. But in my small amount of reading, I didn't see anything that was saying, we've had 2 years of humidity, so the mealybugs have come up, or we lost a natural predator. Did anything come up in your research on that?
You're going to hate this. The only explanation I could find.
Do not say climate change. So go on.
That's all they said. It's because of climate change. And I was like, well, but why? Like, what about it has changed? That's the problem. I also believe the mealybugs themselves aren't specifically the problem. It's a bacteria that they introduce. Yes. So it's a bit like they're the carrier. It's not the rats that spread the plague, it's the fleas kind of thing. Yeah. And they're just really hardy too. If you could kill the mealybugs before they could get properly in, it wouldn't be such a big issue. But the mealybugs are very resistant. So it wouldn't surprise me if there are labs currently working on particular pesticides to kill mealybugs and or even inoculate the mealybugs against the bacteria and things like that. There's probably people working on this right now because this is a huge global industry. Most of it's grown, over half of the world's cacao is grown in Ghana and the Ivory Coast. It's obviously not, it's further manufactured elsewhere in the world, like all over the world. So as much as it's kind of isolated into these areas right now, it's a global issue. And as a result, there's a lot of people throwing funds and new technologies and everything into this. What's kind of upsetting is I think the biggest loser of this is probably going to be the farmers on the ground, the workers on the ground. And a lot of people go, there's probably some people thinking about it this right now as we're talking that, why these places? And it's the perfect climate. It's got the perfect weather. Well, it did until climate change came along. And a large unskilled workforce because they're all picked by hand. It's quite a process. Yeah. And the basic refinement after it's picked and things like that. So as much as we are doing some in Australia, I don't think we could kind of ramp it up in the same level of production. I think very specifically it's in this area in West Africa because of all of these contributing factors. So if we can fix the problem where it is, I think it's going to be better for everyone overall. But I'm sure some bloke in Nestle is cooking up some super, super pesticide to kill everything and save their cocoa industry. There's big players in this industry that are not going to just roll over and let the tap run dry.
No, and look, it's potentially going to introduce such a distortion in the market that it's going to make it more profitable in areas like North Australia to start producing this, the cacao. We do see that with crops that, like, avocados were a classic. Yep. They just when they had sort of the real rise in popularity and the avocado plantations started popping up everywhere, and then there was a normalization process, and you know, people went out of business, other people succeeded, but we may see cacao spread across different parts of the world now that it becomes financially viable at these prices.
It definitely could, and that would kind of, it would be exciting in some ways because we may have like regional varieties and things like that. Unfortunately, again, I think the losers of this would be the local people of that area. In West Africa, they don't have a lot of options in terms of employment opportunities and things like that. It is a notoriously poor area and things like that. So it's sort of, there's an opportunity here, but at the same time, it's you know, it is a bit upsetting for the people that live in that area. But at the same time, that's also, that's just life.
Yep.
And we'll see what happens. There is other areas in Australia that could grow them in far north Queensland and things like that. So maybe once our bananas is another problem. You know, I know that's outside the scope of what we're talking about, but there are a few banana problems going around, and that is a massive monoculture. And it has happened before. We've lost a variety of banana that was the dominant banana variety in the past, and now we have the Cavendish as its replacement. So unfortunately, bananas is a funny one. That's why Australia has such strong import controls on bananas. I don't think there'll be a problem in cross-contamination, cross my fingers, with the cacao plants because it's a bug that specifically lives in the tree, and the raw material of the cacao comes in like dried and semi-processed. So touch wood, from an importation problem, I don't know that this would be a big risk of spreading that disease to the Australian crops. However, I might be wrong. I'm basically talking to my ass, so maybe. If you're a mealybug and you're listening to this, don't come here. Don't come to Darwin, all right? Let's move on to This Week in Australian History.
All right, this week in Australian history, we're covering 26th to 30th of April and the 1st of May. April 26th in 1890, A.B. Banjo Patterson's poem, The Man from Snowy River, is first published. Iconic Australian poem. It's known by a lot of people. It's, you know, spurned movies and is part of the culture. So, yeah, 1890 for that one. 1924, an explosion on the SS Singapore, berthed in Port Adelaide, South Australia, kills 13 people. 1939, Robert Menzies becomes Prime Minister of Australia, succeeding interim Prime Minister Sir Earl Page, who served for 3 weeks after the death of Joseph Lyons. 1970, Queen Elizabeth II opens the National Carillon in Canberra. It was a gift of the British government commemorating the establishment of the national capital. Now, a carillon is a pitched percussion instrument that is played with a keyboard and consists of at least 23 bells, which are cast in bronze and hung in suspension and tuned in chromatic order so they can be sounded harmoniously together, struck with clappers connected to a keyboard or wooden battens, and either played manually or set up to be played automatically.
It's like an organ for bells, basically.
Great. Perfect description. Yep. Perfect description. Carillon in Canberra has 57 bells.
Oh, wow. That's a lot more than I thought.
Yeah. Yes. Ranging nearly 5 octaves. That's pretty good. Yeah. Good description, DK. April 27th, 1804, explorer Matthew Flinders climbs Arthur's Seat on the Mornington Peninsula in present-day Victoria, just down the road from me. In fact, I saw the plaque only at the end of last year. 1896, Sir Henry Parkes, known as the Father of Federation, dies in Annandale, New South Wales, at the age of 80. 1971, relics from the wreck of the Dutch East India Company ship Batavia are recovered off the coast of the Houtman Abrolhos in Western Australia. 2014, three former country Liberal MPs joined the Palmer United Party, becoming the party's first representatives in the Northern Territory's Legislative Assembly. Not a fan of Clive?
My mum told me if you don't have anything nice to say, you shouldn't say anything at all.
Okay, I'll take that Marge-like groan as comment with help. April 28th, 1656, the Vergueda Drake, a Dutch East India Company, and I apologize to all our Dutch listeners who say, what the hell did he just butcher? He didn't even get close there. ship bound for the port of Batavia, now Jakarta, is wrecked south of Ledge Point in present-day Western Australia.
Well, they were a bit off course, weren't they? That was
yeah, just a touch. But it's interesting hearing that 1656, though.
It's a very long time ago.
And you think, too, the Dutch East India Company was a big company. You know, fingers in so many pies around the world. It was very, very successful, very powerful, a real amalgamation of private and government interests in there.
They invented capitalism. So everyone, thank a Dutchman next time you see him.
Vergueda Drake. That's going to be my one. Vergueda Drake. I'll insert it in there afterwards as if I pronounced it correctly. But even that's probably not right. In 1985, in April 28th, 33 members, including Senator Joe Valentine, resigned from the Nuclear Disarmament Party at the National Conference held in Melbourne, claiming the party had been taken over by members of the Socialist Workers' Party.
This is a little bit off topic, but I kind of do love just the how, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the Nuclear Disarmament Party of Australia. Australia doesn't have nuclear weapons. So was this a foreign policy situation? Like, what's the goal here is to rid the world of nuclear weapons, I assume. But that is a bold mission statement to come out with, you know. We're a single issue party and it's this one thing that the Australian government has no control over. Look, actually, coming back to our original story, clearly the government of Australia thinks it has a lot more power than it actually does.
Yeah, as you were saying that, 1996, 35 people are murdered by Martin Bright in the town of Port Arthur, Tasmania. And thankfully, he's still rotting in jail.
Yeah.
April 29th, 1770, Captain James Cook arrives and names Botany Bay aboard HM Bark Endeavour. 1941, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake, the strongest recorded in Australia, hits near the station of Merribee in the Murchison district of Western Australia. 1952, the ANZUS Treaty, a military alliance between Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, hence the term, the acronym ANZUS, comes into force. And still in force and still going reasonably strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not sort of like integrated that into like the Five Eyes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know? It's Yeah, it's still in force, but it's kind of molded into other things as well. So,
Yeah, has morphed a bit. 1954, the Soviet Union's embassy in Canberra is closed as a result of the Petrov affair.
Did they close that or did we close that? Do you know?
I don't know the answer to that at all, actually. I mean, we mentioned it in last week's This Week in Australian History that Petrov affair was a spying scandal for Australia. I don't know whether.
Yep.
Don't know. We'll have to look it up.
We've kicked Russians out recently because of, you know, things that have happened in the last few years. So it wouldn't surprise us if it was us.
Hmm. April 30th, 1915, during the Gallipoli campaign, HMS AE-2, a Royal Australian Navy submarine, is sunk by enemy shellfire in the Sea of Marmara in present-day Turkey. Just wanted to naming last week. AE-2, is that something that they do particular for subs, or that's an acronym or an abbreviation that I don't understand?
I think it was because it was an E-class submarine from the Royal Navy that we purchased. So I think it was sort of like A for Australia, E for E-class submarine, and it was the second one. So I imagine that's where the name came from.
Well, you're going to have a better chance of guessing that than me, but that sounds reasonable. I will now quote that as fact.
Everyone that heard this, it is a fact now.
Yeah, exactly. 1988, the World Expo 88, part of the Australian Bicentenary, opens in Brisbane in Queensland.
Woohoo.
Yeah. 2006, miners Brant Webb and Todd Russell are found alive 5 days after a mine collapse in the Beaconsfield, Tasmania.
And that was one of those moments that really gripped the nation of those guys, getting those guys out. I felt like it was the only thing anyone talked about for those 5 days.
Yep, I'd agree with you. It did, that phrase, captured a nation.
Mm. And it's incredible that they got them out alive and in the condition that they did. They walked out. They tagged out even when they actually left, which was pretty cool. So an incredible effort from everyone that was in the rescue team. And I believe some of the techniques they developed have gone on around the world and helped other mining disasters to recover miners and things like that. So there is a bit of a silver lining for some of these things.
Well, that's interesting. May 1st, 1770, having died of tuberculosis on April 30th, Forbes Sutherland is buried at Cornell in New South Wales, becoming the first British subject buried in Australia. 1891, the first May Day marches in Australia are held at Buckholden in Queensland in support of a shearers' strike.
Oh, progressive Queensland.
Yeah.
Cop that, Victoria.
Yeah. There we go. 1946, the Pilbara strike commences with 800 Aboriginal pastoral workers walking off stations in the Pilbara and Kimberley regions of Western Australia. I don't remember whether we mentioned that in a Two Ticks Town Talk or whether that had come up. Whether I'm just thinking about 12 months ago.
I think we have. I think we've talked about this before.
Yeah, it was ultimately had a fair degree of success. Not complete, but a fair degree of success. It was a good show of force, and people did feel the loss of those workers. So, yeah, it's power to them. 1997, HM Prison, and this is our final one for this week in Australian history. 1997, Her Majesty's Prison Pentridge in Coburg, Victoria, the site of the last execution in Australia, closes after 145 years of operation. And now it's a housing, housing's gone up, apartments have gone up, it's community space.
I do know where that is because a friend of mine was looking to buy a unit just outside the walls. And I said, is this? I wasn't familiar with the area because I notoriously hate Melbourne. And I was very surprised to hear that it was quite the prison. It was the prison. But they've done it up quite nicely. And it is quite a nice area these days. Probably horrendously haunted, I'd imagine.
Oh, look, it's not. like put haunted bit of a callback to our discussion earlier on. It's not the energy of a place where I'd like to live. You know, it's I look, you can look online. There's some, you know, some interesting spaces, and they're sort of trying to preserve the heritage of it. But no, I mean, I wouldn't move into a prison. Ex-prison, wouldn't move into an ex-cemetery. So that's not really my cup of tea, gotta say. But that's the end of this week in Australian history. And as we tend to do at this time, as we move into the Forex Bottle Top Quiz, let's crack a beer. Now, both questions this week are related to digestion. I'm not sure if you're, I have a feeling that one you'll probably nail and the other one you might half nail. So the first is related to our second story, but the second is more stomach turning. So here's the first one. Name the flavors in Cadbury snack.
Snack?
And for international listeners, and you've probably got your own version of it, it's a chocolate bar that has, what have we got, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different shaped pieces of chocolate, each with a distinct flavor. So it's, you know, it's and it's not just sort of like a loose selection. It's actually in the one bar. So
do we still make that? I don't even know. I haven't seen that for a while. Is that still a thing?
I'm pretty sure it still is. I mean, it sounds like you and I eat about the same amount of that sort of chocolate.
I do. <don't.
laughs> okay, so this might be a bit of a tricky one.
Okay,
for you.
I do know the one. I've had it before. Yep. What are the flavors?
There's a couple of unusual.
How many are there?
There's six.
Did you say? There's six. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a strawberry one.
Yep.
I want to say there's caramel.
Yep. Now you start getting into hang on, what was that last one?
Yeah, Turkish Delight, I think, might be one. Is that one?
Oh, I thought Yep. Turk. Wow. Okay.
Because they're just like the normal chocolate ones, right? Like, what are in roses? What's that? Three. So there's three more.
What are the flavors?
One of them you should know, being a Queenslander.
Pineapple. Yep. Is there? Yep. Is there a pineapple one?
There's pineapple in there. And
I don't think I've had the pineapple piece. That'll either be really good or really gross.
Pineapple and Turkish Delight used to be one of my favorites when I was younger and ate them. And because people didn't like them as much, it was sort of a bonus. So two left.
Two left. So what? Oh, I don't think there's like a nougat one. Pretty sure there's not. Yeah. Nope. Because that's so common in chocolate. It's not like.
But if you sort of were thinking a lot, it's not nougat, but if you're sort of thinking along that style rather than sort of like a bit of caramel popping out, if you're thinking more of a structured style.
I love how you're giving me tips but not a structured but not nougat. And we've already done caramel. It wouldn't be.
It's two coloured, one of which is white.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a bit like the Bounty. Is it coconut?
Ooh. Oh, you're halfway there.
Coconut and something. Coconut. I don't know.
It's called coconut something. It's called coconut ice. That's close.
Oh, coconut ice. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And you've got one.
I think I've had the coconut one because I like a Bounty.
I don't mind a Bounty.
I don't see them very much anymore now that I think about it. I don't eat a lot of chocolate, so And there's one left. It wouldn't be... I'm just thinking of like the popular flavors of confectioneries, right? These companies are notoriously lazy. They're not going to reinvent something. No, they're just going to recycle the stuff that they've already got, right? So what do we got? We got strawberry, Turkish delight, caramel.
I'll give you a hint. It's a color.
I've forgotten too. Them already. It's a color. Oh, red. No. Yeah. It must be orange. Then.
It is. Yeah. It is. Well done. So.
That's the only color I can think of that has a flavor.
Yes. Yeah. So strawberry, caramel, orange, coconut ice, pineapple, and Turkish delight.
Actually, now that you say that, I'm sure the orange bit is orange wedge shaped, isn't it?
Oh, they're all like this. I don't know. I think the caramel is typically a square. I don't know why square is what goes with caramel, but all the others are. And Turkish delight. I can't remember what that's. Oh, Turkish delight is almost like, from memory, it's almost like a sort of curved shell shape, I think.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind it. Wouldn't mind a.
I'd have to go out and buy one before they get very expensive. Yeah, keep it in the cupboard. You might sell it. It might go up in price.
Yeah, exactly. Invest in chocolate. All right. Now, for the second one, what creature can turn its stomach inside out?
Cane toads do that, don't they?
Cane toads?
Cane toads, yeah. Pretty sure they like vomit their stomach out of their mouth. It's gross.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's not the answer.
I don't know. Oh, what what turns their stomach inside out?
I'll give you a hint. It's in the ocean.
It's in the ocean. Like sea cucumbers, like spew their guts up, don't they?
My God, that's not the answer too. I mean, how many things are throwing up their stomach? I don't know that they're throwing it up. They're just, they're turning it up. And when I give you the explanation, it'll tell you why they do it.
What?
Sea cucumber, you're certainly correct. It's on the ocean floor.
It's on the ocean floor. There's a lot of fish that live on the ocean floor.
Let me give you an obscure hint. When we were talking about the horror movie, I gave it a rating. How do you typically rate movies?
With stars. So is it a sea star, some sort of starfish?
Yep, exactly right.
Interesting.
Yeah, so starfish turn their stomachs inside out to feed on their prey, a process called stomach eversion, E-V-E-R-S-I-O-N. It allows them to digest their food externally, which is necessary because they prey on things such as mussels and clams that have hard shells that can't be easily opened from the inside. So when a starfish encounters a meal like that, it uses its tube feet to pry open the shell, then extends its stomach out of its mouth and over the prey. The stomach's covered with enzymes that break down the prey's soft tissues, creating a soup-like substance, which the starfish then withdraws its stomach back into its body, and the digested food is absorbed through its digestive glands. What a way to go.
That sounds so gross. I'm not going to lie. It sounds so, so gross.
They should have poor clam, just sort of like things are sort of opening and then this tube comes in. Suddenly you're just getting, you're inside your clam and getting enveloped by this thing and thinking, oh, this is unpleasant. And all of a sudden you start to feel yourself dissolving and, yeah.
Terrible way to go. Absolutely.
Better ways to go.
That's right. Anyway, on that bombshell, thank you so much for listening to another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. If you have any feedback or suggestions for topics, please get in touch with us on the r/Australian subreddit or email us at australiansubreddit@proton.me. We'd also be grateful if you could subscribe and give us an honest review, as this helps us out with that algorithm immensely. Otherwise, join us next week for another episode of Australia Talks. And remember, at r/Australian, we are Australian. Thanks for listening, and tell your mum I love her.
Thanks, DK. See ya.
See ya.